Invisible Illness. For the purpose of this podcast, this term will encompass hidden mental and physical conditions.
We're Freya and Liv, students at the University of Nottingham, and in each episode we will be exploring the impact these invisible conditions can have.
That's why this week we spoke to Parul about her experience caring for someone with non-verbal autism.
Just a heads up, some people might find some of the things we discuss here uncomfortable.
If you need it, there will be useful contact details in the description below.
Sian was a, what you would call normally functioning up till about 3 and 5 months. And he started to show signs of losing abilities in certain areas. So, for example, he was speaking perfectly normally and started losing speech. So he would sort of repeatedly ask questions, like if he was in the car, he'd ask me what the gear stick was, and I'd say, well, it's a gear stick. And he might say, what's that? So I'd say, well, it's an indicator. But he'd keep asking me these questions over and over again. But I didn't click. I thought he was playing a game at first. But then began to realise that actually something's not quite right. But his school had noticed that he'd sort of stopped talking first. So he hadn't quite stopped talking at home, but he had stopped talking at school first. And then it sort of, or it may have been that it was pittering out at home and we hadn't noticed. Or that he was just speaking less. And then following that, certain behaviours started to come into play as well. For example, he started hand flapping, and he had facial tics, so his face would tick and started sucking sleeves and so on. So you could see that he was becoming more distressed. And for example, he was potty trained, so what he would do would suddenly started wetting himself again and started having difficulty sleeping at night. And generally, just very clingy, much more clingy, not able to go to nursery again. Although he still liked going, he was having problems at nursery, fitting in with the other children. At one point, one of his fellow pupils said to me, I think he's deaf. I thought, oh, this is crazy. I mean, it all happened very quickly. So he sort of seemed to lose speech within about 2 weeks. It sort of went from full speech to odd words by the end of the 2 weeks. So we sort of immediately, obviously, got in touch with the local services, and the health visitor came over and basically saw a psychologist who indicated that she thought it might be autism. But we were so alarmed, we didn't sort of, that we thought we were sort of actually even angry, because we thought, well, he was fine, how can it be autism? So I guess we had limited understanding of autism. Then following that, Great Ormond Street diagnosed him with autism, so that kicked off really, I suppose, the care aspect of things, because immediately you're thrown into all of the sort of alarming, it's a shock and alarming things. So then you sort of come into contact with services that are so appalling that you're going back 10 years. So there may have been a slight improvement, but I don't think so. But going with what's happening currently, it's incredibly difficult to get the level of support that you need. So you have to just sort of go with what's happening, and at every stage there's a new stage that comes along that you kind of have to deal with. So with Sian, Great Ormond Street Hospital gave a diagnosis of autism. You know, they started having to do to say, well, we want an MRI scan, because we couldn't believe what's happened, because if we showed you videos, he was a verbal child being able to do everything up till the age of 3 and 4 months, and then just suddenly there's this sort of loss of speech and loss of skill.
I think it's probably important to just make listeners aware that the person who's speaking on this podcast episode is, her name's Pearl, she's my mum, and the person who she's talking about, the boy with nonverbal autism, is my brother Stian.
I think we'd also like to make it clear that although this episode is about autism, it is specifically about nonverbal autism.
Yeah, it's necessary for people to understand that this is a podcast more about people's personal experiences than about trying to define an entire illness by episode.
Exactly, and I think you can't define an illness by one person's experience. And I think one thing that we've talked about a lot on this podcast already is the idea that invisible illnesses, and you know, to a certain extent all illnesses, are very different for the different people that suffer for them, and everybody has a different experience of that.
Yeah, so in this first clip, Pearl speaks about the initial regression of her son. And essentially what happened was that he went from being a fairly sort of neurotypical boy at the age of 3 years old who was speaking, who was perfectly social, for want of a better word, grew up fairly normally. And then from the age of 3.5, within a few weeks, he regressed to the point of being unable to speak, having facial tics, having nervous behaviours, being unable to kind of process and engage socially.
I think first, just for anyone listening who may not have a good understanding of what autism is, that we're just going to provide a couple of different definitions that are available to people on the internet from different websites. First of all, the NHS defines autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, as the name for a range of similar conditions, including Asperger's syndrome, that affects a person's social interaction, communication, interests, and behaviour. In particular, in children with ASD, the symptoms are present before 3 years of age, although diagnosis can sometimes be made after the age of three.
On a similar kind of wavelength, but on the other hand, the National Autistic Society, NAS, describes autism as a lifelong developmental disability that affects how people perceive the world and interact with others. They say that autistic people see, hear and feel the world differently to other people. And if you're autistic for life. It's not an illness or disease and cannot be cured. Often people feel being autistic is a fundamental aspect of their identity. I think it's worth, again, noting that when they talk about fundamental aspects of identity, a lot of the time that comes along with the understanding that you have this kind of disability. And what's crucial to understand about the child that we're talking about in this podcast is that his understanding of his disability is very limited. He's not high functioning. He has fairly severe autism and he's nonverbal. And it changes the way that he and other people interact with his autism.
Before this episode, I hadn't had much experience with autism myself. I knew a little bit about it. I had a very vague understanding. But obviously, before every episode, me and Freya do some research. And I think for me this week, something that really helped me was some TED Talks, which Freya sent me links to in advance. And I think that's what really made it clear to me what autism is, because I think even now the definitions that the NHS and the NAS both provide, it's still, I feel like they're both quite basic and vague. And so I think we'll the links to these TED Talks we will post in the comments below. So do go have a look at those, because I think they're very, very interesting and provide a good understanding and a definition of what autism is.
They're worth listening to. The problem is that a lot of media, and this is something we discuss in the media episode, pertains a lot towards sort of like high functioning autism, and there's a lot of difficulties that come with high functioning autism. We spoke to a woman recently who said she finds it frustrating because people expect her to be able to do more than she feels she can, and in some respects that is contributes to the invisibility of her illness. And maybe one thing that made Stian's illness so visible to his family straight away was the fact that he went from, you know, he went from speaking all the time, he went from arguing with his family and stuff like that, and from just being this kid who was so kind of full of life and full of love and really wanted to run around and scream and shout like a neurotypical child, to this kid who was afraid and who couldn't speak or communicate, and you had these like facial tics and stuff. And it was, as you know, Pearl describes, it's this massive shock, and you don't really know how to understand it. And obviously, I think it needs to be understood that this was in the early 2000s when this diagnosis was given, and there was massive stigma around autism, which is something Pearl goes on to talk about later. And even now we have stigma around autism. Even now people don't understand what it is, but this was a time when autism was a bad word.
I also think that there's a massive lack of understanding, and because there's a lack of understanding, often I think that means that there's a lot of fear associated with the word, because people hear it but they don't know what it means. They have a vague impression, a vague idea. And I'm included amongst those people. Before this podcast, I had a vague idea, but I didn't really know.
The thing is, I've grown up with a person with autism, but I don't think that gives me the right to try and define what autism is. I'm not a person who experiences it. I'm a person who lives with someone who experiences it. And I don't want to take ownership of something that isn't mine. So I think it's okay, the fact that, like, it's not the fact that people don't know what it is that's the problem. I think it's the approach that people take. And, like, Pearl here speaks about the initial kind of regression and how shocking it was. And I think that's a thing that is hard to understand, because autism is so strange and it does happen. One day a child will be behaving and functioning like a neurotypical child, and then the next day, or within the next few weeks, they regress. It's not just what happened with Stian.
I think as well, obviously in this episode we're talking specifically about nonverbal autism, but I think because autism, you know, it's a spectrum and it's so broad and so wide, and there are different, I don't want to say symptoms, what's the word?
It manifests in different ways.
Yeah, it manifests in different ways in different people. And I think as well that's maybe hard for some people to comprehend who don't know much about it initially at first. And I don't think that's an excuse. I just think that there's not enough information for people, perhaps. And I think that's something that we need to change, because I think we all need a better understanding about it, because actually it affects a lot of people. The NHS, I think... the NHS say it's estimated that about 1 in every 100 people in the UK have ASD.
ASD is so, so common. The NHS say that more boys are diagnosed with the condition than girls, but that doesn't necessarily mean that more boys have autism. This was a misconception I had before doing some research and speaking to people with autism, stuff like that. And, you know, I've discovered myself, and this is from living with someone with autism for well over 10 years now, is that you can't put autism in a box. You can't say more boys have autism than girls. You can't say this is a manifestation of autism, because it's so broad ranging. And in order to not invalidate someone's experience of autism, you have to come to terms with the idea that you can't just label the symptoms. And this is the thing. Stian's an example of a child with very severe autism, who can't speak, who lost the ability to speak. And that's not how it manifests in all people. And it's a sad and a very hard manifestation. It was hard for everyone, probably most of all him. And that regression is... I think that's something that you don't want to see happen to your child. And I think as a kid, when it happened, I was 7 years old, I was protected from that. But when you're a parent and you have to watch that happen to your child, and when you're a carer, I think that must be so hard.
Although he's had the diagnosis, what happens is there's no one to kind of explain to you what's actually happening. There's very little understanding about autism and how and how this happens, and you know, you're in shock. So obviously, as a mother and a father, you begin to get into the care role because you care about your family and your children and so on. So we then contacted the Tavistock Centre to get an insight into how to manage Stian's kind of new behaviours. Because obviously when you lose communication or you can't speak, then there are a range of communications that range of difficulties that come along, because suddenly this child is not able to tell you, or the person is not able to tell you what they need. And so you embark on a series of courses that are put to you by other people on how to manage behavior and so on. So you suddenly become this person who was quite able to manage their children and all this sort of stuff, with having to take advice from external bodies about how to behavior manage. In our case, we sort of feel, well, we can actually behavior manage. We just need additional help with certain other things. So, for example, communication, you go and do a course yourself, right, to be able to help your child at home. But in school, they don't understand how to manage your child. I'm talking about mainstream, but I'm also talking about special schools. It's so difficult. So you go to specialist provision, and what you think is specialist provision, and it being really difficult in mainstream school to get speech and language therapists and OTs and other people that need to be able to help your child. And in fact, what happens in mainstream school, they actually don't want your child there in the first instance, because they're not able to help, or the funding's not there, so they can actually help with what is needed. So you find that actually you come across a brick wall because there isn't help there. Then you go to special school and you think, I've got there, you're going to get the right kind of help. But what happens is that help isn't really there, because the expertise isn't there. And what you find is that you yourself are finding out and learning so much about your child's disability that you often then go into school and you meet with people and they aren't sort of aware of the latest sort of things that are out there, perhaps. And in our case, what it was that we found that our son was able to use a communication aid, right? That whilst speech therapy was going on, it was quite slow. But a communication aid may have helped him sooner. But we sort of introduced it to the school, and what you found was that actually nobody knew how to use it, or didn't know much about it, or the training couldn't be put in place soon enough. In Sian's case, we started behind that sort of avenue, so that the speech therapy could continue, but at least he could start taking part in education and be within the education system if he could communicate with something that was faster. He was having difficulty with handwriting because of the fine motor difficulties meant that he couldn't handwrite, but he could type faster, so or learn to type. But he found that there's no expertise in schools to be able to teach that, or the schools that we went to that were meant to be specialist schools. And so the help we needed at home in terms of that sort of thing wasn't there, but also in terms of challenging behaviours, it was difficult to understand that it was supporting, that actually there aren't any experts out there to help you with these things. And I think particularly with autism, there's not many people who can help address these issues. Some of it comes down to communication, but also lack of it. And within the school system, it seems like there just doesn't, the expertise in the areas just isn't there.
Just to provide a few definitions before we get started, Pearl speaks about an OT, which is an occupational therapist. Occupational therapy basically aims to improve your ability to do everyday tasks.
Isn't that one amongst a few different types of therapy that are offered to people who have been diagnosed with autism? I think, for example, on the NHS website, other therapies include speech and language therapy, educational support, and it says a number of other interventions that are available to help children and parents. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume that because each case of autism is completely different, that they see which types of therapy or support work best for that child or adult?
Kind of. A lot of the time you'll see them work in conjunction with each other. So Stian had speech and language therapy and he had occupational therapy. The extent to which they were successful or useful is questionable. But also, she speaks about OT, which is occupational therapy. She also talks about a place called the Tavistock Centre, which is a specialist mental health trust in London. And this is a place where not only did Stian receive help, but the family received help. So there was like family counselling and stuff like that. And it's interesting that it's a mental health trust because it was probably one of the most helpful things in a lot of respects for Stian, but it wasn't necessarily directly geared at autism. But this clip is essentially about kind of the initial shock and I think the change in identity when you get into a care role.
And I think after speaking to Parul, something that was very evident was that this diagnosis was given and then it seemed like there was suddenly perhaps like a lack of support. It sounds like, you know, Parul and her husband were just kind of left to figure out how best to help Stian due to a lack of services.
The thing is, it took about 2 years before they were even able to get a diagnosis. It's not... They went through, you know, initially... She speaks in the first clip about this child at his school saying, I think he's deaf. They went through testing to see if he was deaf, if he was a selective or elective mute, all of these kind of things. It's not... It took a long time to get the diagnosis. And then when you get that diagnosis, you have to adjust to this care role. Your identity completely changes, but there is a lack of services and there's a lack of genuine support, especially I think in the early 2000s, as she was saying, like there's very little, almost desire to engage with autism.
I was very shocked as well to hear about how the specialist schools or provisions that you think are specifically designed to support and help people with autism were actually unhelpful.
Yeah, the problem
in a lot of ways.
The problem is you've got mainstream school, and you know, I'm not inclined to talk that much about my personal experiences, but me and Stian went to the same primary school initially, and he was there just after his diagnosis, and there was one other little boy who had, I don't know if he had autism, he had some form of disability that was fairly similar to what Stian had. And I just remember seeing them, they'd be like a teaching assistant and they'd be taken out of class and I'd see them if I was in PE or whatever. And they'd just like take them around the playground and they wouldn't be in lessons, they wouldn't be engaging with the other students or anything like that. They'd just be taken out because they were seen as a nuisance. And that's in mainstream school. And then, you know, Parul talks about the fact they finally get to special school and there's a lack of provision, especially with state-funded specialist schools. The first school that Stian was at was not particularly good. And that continues even into some of the, apparently the best special schools in the country, there's this kind of lack of... not. I don't know if it's a lack of understanding when you get to that level of specialism, but I think there's a lack of belief in autonomy, almost. Like, there's a lack of personhood, almost, that comes along with this, especially with nonverbal autism. And Perul goes on later to speak about this kind of separation and distinction between verbal and nonverbal students at the special schools. There's also this discussion of doing a lot of things alone, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think it must take somebody incredibly strong to be able to go through that. And
I think,
and you know, I've met Perul. She's an amazing woman, and you know, I have a lot of respect for her, an incredible amount of respect.
Yeah, I think Perul and obviously Steve, this is what I keep reiterating throughout this discussion point, is that like, it's a change in identity. You go from a parent to a carer, and although that might seem like they're not the same thing, or they might seem like the same thing, there's a distinction between caring for a child who is neurotypical and caring for a child who requires a lot more support and is unable to tell you what's wrong. It's things like when Stian was a kid, he might have got a bee sting. He wouldn't have been able to tell anyone. It'd be obvious that he was in pain and no one would know why. And you have to find a way to deal with that as a parent. Coming to terms with the fact that your child, as the NHS definition says, there's no cure for autism. Coming to terms with the fact that your child may never speak again, may never have the future that you thought that they were going to have. And that's hard, and it's a breaking point for a lot of people, and you can understand why. And for Stian, it must have been so confusing, because it's difficult to know the extent even now that he is aware of his disability, but no one understands how much he experienced his regression. No one understands the kind of fear that he went through when, as a little child, he went from... I've seen, you know, home videos of him running around the kitchen with this lollipop in his hand and being like, this is my lollipop, it's pink. To being a child who could only scream and could only communicate with sounds and facial tics.
Well, the most recent thing that obviously I've been reading up on, we made a programme called What Can Science Do For Me? And we met Simon Baron Cohen, who gave us some good advice on sort of how to work with Stian. But this is the thing about being a sort of parent of, or carer, if you want to use the term carer, because you're a parent, actually, who has a more advanced, greater need for caring. As your child grows older, in the age 16, but you're caring in a similar way to you would a younger child. So both me and my husband, Steve, what we do is we provide care 24/7, but it starts from the start of the day at 7 o'clock in the morning, or you get up a little bit earlier, but about 7 o'clock in the morning till bedtime, and sometimes beyond that because of sleep problems and so on. So in Sian's case, he goes through different periods or different states, and at the moment he's gone to an extreme prompt dependency state, and that usually arises because there's some form of anxiety that he's suffering. So, for example, what we notice is that crossing from one room to the other, so a hallway, is a problem for him. So some sort of perhaps OCD or type behaviour where you stand at the door and he won't be able to step out of the door. So you have to kind of say, come on, you can do it, you can step out. And then you step out. I can't figure out what it's to do with it. At the moment, it feels like he's got himself extremely worried about the sort of holes, because we've got wooden floorboards. So it's the lines in the wooden floorboards. So you'll cross over to the toilets, and then you'll be standing there, and you have to say, come on, you need to go with your, so he's prompt dependent to an extreme. And then that will happen when he's finished. Says, come on, then we have to come out of the room. So that takes another couple of minutes or whatever. To say, look, you're okay. You need to come out of there. You can go in the bathroom now. You can get in the shower now. You can, well, you need to take your clothes off. So every little thing needs a prompt. Is a state that you can get into when you're highly stressed. Now, I'm a parent, so what I'm doing is I'm reading about things on the internet, because there isn't a single body that you can go to get help with this and to ask the questions that you need to ask. Well, why is something happening? No one seems to know, and there is no one who can help you. You're forever going on the internet, or you might sort of fall onto something, because when you have a child with autism, most people disappear, and your friendship circle gets a bit smaller, because I'm talking about friendship groups in terms of your child's friendship group. You see, you have your old friends and so on, but in terms of where, for example, when my daughter was younger, you had a lot of mothers and friends, and you'd all meet together, or they'd go to parties together, and children would come over to your place, and you know, you'd have that sort of environment. In Sian's case, that it started off like that when he was verbal, but as soon as he lost his speech and the diagnosis of autism, I think in his case there was sort of one friend who remained that he could actually go to or sort of still come over or so on, and that sort of petered out because we moved, so perhaps that would have gone on. But that's what happens. The isolation for your child begins, so you can't actually help them in socializing and learning about socializing, because the friendships disappear, they peter out. That's taking us again back to when he's younger, but as he grows older, the isolation remains, and the person that he's most dependent on is parents. So the care role never stops. It's complete in the sense that your mother, father, friends, so whatever activity you do, it may be swimming or cycling or whatever it is, where at a certain point with a younger child, they start to do that with their friends. Come age 12, 13, they might go out with their friends. Your child with autism can't do that because there aren't any friends that he could go with or go alone with. So you are always going to the swimming pool and so on, and even sometimes when you don't want to, you're getting in the pool and swimming with them, or you're playing tennis with them, or you're cycling with them or whatever. And at the back of it, there's always this wish that there could be friends for them or people that would kind of... that they could group with and do things with. And unfortunately, because they're in a special school, you never get to meet the parents, because it's almost like, in my son's case, closed doors at the school gate, because parents can't get to meet each other. They come from different areas to the school. They come on a different bus and so on. So you don't get to meet other parents and introduce children to each other. So even though that if they, you know, and they say autism is a social and communication difficulty, well, it's definitely a communication difficulty, but social difficulty, it's so not understood, because Sian is a very social person. He wants friendship, just that he can't speak. So he would love it to have friends around and people around and interact with them. He enjoys that. But it's so limiting because you can't actually get friendships or friends make friends if you don't have speech?
Well, the first thing that Paul talks about here is Sian's kind of developmental difficulties and kind of what it takes in a day to look after him and keep his life kind of going on and being okay. And I think something I want to bring up here is this idea of, she talks about prompt dependency and she talks about anxiety, and I think this is very important, is this idea of mental health in people with disabilities, especially invisible disabilities and especially autism. Because with regards to nonverbal people, when you're nonverbal, how can you not have incredible levels of anxiety?
And also, how do you speak to people about that? How do you let people know how you're feeling? How do you share those worries, that anxiousness with other people so that they can try and help you deal with that?
Yeah, Stian has a lot of fear and it's unclear what that is, but this leads to this kind of level of like prompt dependency where you have to, you know, when he gets up in the morning, it's kind of like one foot out of the bed and the other foot. Now you have to stand up. Now you have to go to the toilet. Make sure when you're in the toilet, you flush the toilet. Make sure you come out. And it takes, on average in a day, about maybe like an hour and a bit to get him ready. And the problem is, it's not just about the time that it takes with the anxiety. It's about also, you know, he's a 16-year-old. And there's a level of like loss of dignity when you have to have someone guide you into the toilet or guide you into the shower and stuff like that. It's very like, it's not his fault. It's not anyone's fault. It's just how it is, because how are you supposed to avoid that when someone can't get ready on their own? It just is what it is. And I think it's this kind of thing of like never quite advancing beyond your childlike stages. And in that respect, when you're a carer for someone with this kind of severe level of disability, you never progress beyond being the parent of a young child. And my parents do their best with this kind of like developmental thing of allowing him to be a teenager and stuff like that. But there's levels where they're always going to have to treat him like a child. And that's hard for them and it's hard for him, because he's still a kid going through puberty, growing up, becoming an adult. But developmentally, he's stuck at a childhood stage.
I think as well, in this clip, Parul begins to talk about the effect it has, the effect that this has had on friendships, not just Deanne's friendships, but I think also on a family level, the friendships they have with other families and other people. And I think something she stresses is that when someone is nonverbal, that actually really socially isolates them, because although they can be a very social person, they are unable to sustain friendships because other people can perhaps find it difficult when they can't speak to someone. And that's not Sian's fault.
Yeah, the thing is with that is that, as we were saying, like, autism is very wide-ranging. I was reading an article written by a person with nonverbal autism. So it's not necessarily to say that people with nonverbal autism can't have friends, but in Stian's case, there's so many developmental barriers. There's so much that's preventing him from being able to make those social connections. And let's not get it twisted, Stian doesn't have any friends. Stian doesn't have friends at school. He doesn't have friends outside of school. He has a family who love him very much and would do anything for him. And it's sad in a lot of ways, because like when his and my niece and nephew come over and stuff like that, he's so excited because there's other children there and stuff like that. When our cousins come over, he's so excited because, as Parul says, he's a social person. He loves being around people. He has difficulties in sensory areas and stuff like that, and he can't maybe do it for a long time, but there's just barriers. You know, the only sort of friends he has really are his immediate family. And at the same time, you know, the person who's closest to his age is me, his sister, and I'm away at uni all the time.
I think another thing to stress here is that, you know, we talk a lot about how autism affects people differently, but that obviously extends to specific kind of categories of autism. So, for example, like Freya was just saying, just because somebody has nonverbal autism doesn't mean they're gonna experience it in the same way as somebody else who has nonverbal autism.
Mm-hmm. I think with autism, a lot of the time there is a level of social isolation, whether you're verbal or non-verbal, purely because obviously autism is largely to do with social abilities and things like that. There's obviously other things that go into it. And with a kind of invisible disability like autism as well, you'll have kids that will come up to Stian at like playgrounds and stuff, and like maybe there's an element of wanting to make friends, but it disappears. And it's not, you know, you can't blame a child for being unable to make friends with a kid who they can't speak to. No one's saying that like they're bad people for that. It's just hard. And for Paul and Steve, it was massively hard as well, because you do lose friends when your kid isn't hanging out in the playground playing with the other kids or stuff like that. And you lose a kind of social grouping, I think. And people aren't necessarily willing to stick about when things get hard. It's just part and parcel, isn't it? Not in a kind of way that I'm throwing that away, but what else are you meant to do? There's just that I think your options become limited when you live with or care for someone with an invisible disability that has so much stigma surrounding it and so little understanding.
I mean, it's not a nice thing to say, I guess, but you feel as though you've lost your child, right? And this person is still your child, but that, because the sort of interaction, communication was so full and so joyous and so every day. And, you know, I remember him coming up to me and saying, "Mummy, Freya won't let me play violin," because he's trying to get your violin off you. And then all of a sudden, you haven't got any of those interactions anymore. It's completely changed. And where obviously you still love him and don't fully understand the situation because you're very young, it's a very, for parents, you're just looking at despair, really. I was in a cathedral shortly after all this, and I picked up a card, and it said, the devil is in the despair. So after that, I always kept that in my mind, because you despair because you're looking at the future and you're thinking, well, what's the future going to be for this person? Because the services are so poor and people's understanding is so poor that you know, so what is going to happen in the future? And from that point, when I read that card, which said, "The devil is in the despair," I don't let myself despair. I always try and stay hopeful, that and look and just think of each day. So only work on today and tomorrow. Because the minute you start looking at the future and thinking, oh, you know, what's going to happen when I'm not around anymore, or you know, in terms of education, this child needs an education, but there aren't, people just don't know how to educate this person. And you know that they're, you know, they're intelligent, they can learn, they have abilities. And I'm sorry to say this, but in my son's school, which is a special needs school, there's still two sort of, there's divisions for the higher functioning children with autism and the non-verbal children. So the non-verbal children even physically have been put to the side of sort of these makeshift classrooms, little huts at the edge of the main school building. I think they would deny it, but actually it was so obvious that more effort has gone into the verbal children who are able to speak and so on than the non-verbal children. If you saw the homework that comes home, it's really appalling. Still would be doing things that he was doing at sort of 5 or 6 years old. And the underestimation because he's nonverbal. So all this is part of the care you feel, obviously, because you don't want it that way. You want to change things, but you're fighting that battle every single day. Every single day, you wake up in the morning and you think, right, okay. So you sort of have to remain hopeful that you can make the changes, and that you have to keep battling and you have to keep fighting, and that you cannot give up, because this is someone's life, that is someone who's dependent on you. But I have to add to this that, you know, you also have a normal life. So, for example, you know, your daughter needs you, or your other children need you, you've got grandchildren, your parents need you, because they're getting older. So, of course, the main care is about the person who has autism, but one piece of sort of advice that the first initial psychologist gave me was try and keep life as normal as possible. Well, normal life means that you have to care about other people, like mum and, you know, my mum and dad, who are elderly, 87 and 80, and they've got various complications and problems. There's my mother-in-law, who's also 92, so obviously needing some assistance and care. You do have to be dealing with other aspects of normal life. But if the services were helpful, and if you didn't feel as though everywhere you went there was a brick wall that you had to break down or fight to just get the right provision for your child, and even when you kind of go through that tribunal and get the right provision for your child, what happens is, and they don't follow it up, schools don't do it, they ignore what's on the statements and the EAC plans. And when you go to the doctor, I mean, this is really appalling, to be honest. My son has what I feel is a sinus problem, and also suffers from migraine headaches and so on. And he developed a sort of burping behavior, right, which initially started, I think, something to do with food, but you can also see that it's anxiety related too. But because he doesn't speak, when you go to the doctor's it's like, oh, it's autism. You know, it's autism. Autistic or people with autism can get ill, but it's everything's put down to a behaviour. But nobody explains to you what that is. I mean, why is there a behaviour? You know, what's the behaviour? It's related to not being able to say what's wrong or that there is something going on. So if it's not being able to, or everything is so loud, or there's too much light here, or all of those things, not being able to explain that's going on. If you just put it down to a behavior that was the term that nobody understands. Recently, my son, was it, first brother's Dion, was finding it difficult to eat. So because of this prompt dependency, which was going on at home, and obviously there was a bit of anxiety about certain things, he would eat very, very slowly. It would take him up to 2-3 hours to eat a meal. We're also thinking, well, what's going on here? And we took him to the dentist and had to take him to a specialist dentist because he seemed to have problems with some molars at the back. But whilst we were there at Guy's Hospital, eventually ended up there because we'd been about 6 times to the dentist but couldn't get to the bottom of what was wrong. And referred to Guy's Hospital, they, within minutes, were able to tell us that he's got a massive ulcer in his mouth, which obviously made it very difficult for him to eat. Within 2 days of them finding that and giving us the medication, the problem was solved, and he was able to eat again in a normal way. So these are the sort of issues that are a problem. The sort of things that you face daily, and that's because the right kind of help isn't there. I mean, wouldn't it be lovely to go to a doctor who understood about autism and was able to say, ah, I know someone who can help with this or that, or some specialist or other. But there just doesn't seem to be anybody who can help.
I think the first thing that's kind of spoken about in this clip is initially about loss, I think, and the fact that Pearl says that she went through a period of feeling like she'd lost her child. And I'm sure that's a sort of statement that garners criticism. But when you are in that situation, how can you not experience loss? How can you not grieve for the child that you once had, even as much as you love your child and as much as you know that that's still your child? When that change happens, we spoke about this sort of thing in the dementia episode, regression, and Sue called it a living bereavement. And in some respects, when someone regresses that quickly, when they lose so many aspects of what you consider to be who they were, I think that grieving makes sense. Equally, Pearl goes on to then say that she had a change in attitude, and this is the thing, it's been 10 years now, and you never stop loving that person, and you don't love someone any less because they have, I call autism a disability. Some people, I'm talking about this particular form of autism that's very disabling. It's, it's classed as a behavioural difficulty, social difficulty. There's a lot of different ways of describing it, but Pearl talks about this change in attitude, doesn't she? And like learning that you have to just continue your life and you can't spend all your time trying to fix your child.
I think perhaps there comes a moment or a stage where at some point you just have to accept it, mm-hmm. as tough as it is, and you can continue to grieve and it's going to continue to be difficult. But like Pearl says, like, she decided that, you can't just despair, you've got to continue.
And she said earlier in the episode that at a certain point she realised that, Steve and Pearl realised that they had to stop trying to throw cures or remedies at Stian because he's still a person and that was affecting his quality of life as well. And, it's a change in attitude, isn't it? She talks also about the future and making provisions for later life. And I think that's something that carers for people with not just invisible disabilities or illnesses, but visible disabilities and illnesses have to deal with.
I think this is particularly relevant to any parent who steps into the carer role for their child and who know that, that carer role is going to continue past childhood,
mm-hmm.
because actually due to the nature of life, there's, as sad as it is, parents at some point may not be there to support their children anymore.
And especially when you have a child with some form of disability or illness, visible or otherwise, you have to make sure that you're making future provisions for them. And obviously, at a certain extent, all parents have to make sure they're making future provisions for their child, but you don't know what's going to happen when you have a child with nonverbal autism who is incapable of looking after themselves. And obviously, Stian has other family, but some people aren't in that position.
And I think something that Pearl talks about as well is that whilst all this is going on, and obviously you've got all these things that you've got to think about, like the future and, trying to care for this person, but you're also trying to carry on with normal life and sustain that, not just for Stian and for yourself, but for your other family members. And I think that must be something that's really difficult when...
It's a balancing act, isn't it? And I won't lie, obviously when I was younger, there were points when I felt left out. And I felt like I wasn't receiving as much love. And that wasn't fair of me, but I was a kid. I was a child who didn't understand what was going on. And it's so hard, I think, as a parent of a child with a condition like Stian's, because how would you continue normal life when your normal life is completely upheaved? And it's a testament to, you know, my parents, but parents of any child or carers of any person, if they manage to have some kind of, I'm reluctant to say, but some kind of normality in their life, something that keeps them from feeling like every day is just painful.
Another thing that Parul continues to speak about is the schooling system here in England. And me and Freya found a very interesting statistic from the NAS website, which said that 63% of children on the autism spectrum are not in the kind of school their parents believe would best support them. And that is a massive number. That's over half.
I would say it's more, to be honest, because, like, there's kids, and Stian is one of them, who are in schools that are meant to be fantastic, in schools that you have to pay fees for, whether that comes from local authorities or from your own pocket, that just don't do enough. You know, Stian's school, as Parul mentioned, operates an informal system of segregation, if you like, where the verbal and non-verbal children are split up. And obviously, those children need different provisions. But it's the fact that there's an underestimation of what a non-verbal child can do. And Stian, as Parul says, is being sent home with homework that he was still doing when he was 6 years old. And the fact that he's capable of more, but there's kind of an assumption that non-verbal people are not capable of as much as verbal people. And it's interesting as well, because people obviously always bring up this thing, oh, people with autism, they've got special skills, don't they? They can do this and that and that. But you don't get that assumption with non-verbal people, I feel like, a lot of the time. When you see a person who's non-verbal, you don't assume that they are able to do things.
In terms of when he was a child, oh, it was lovely in some ways, because you go on the trains and the buses and people were really, really, because he was a very beautiful, gorgeous looking boy. Still is, but he's 16 now. So when he was sort of 4 and 5 years old, he'd go on the buses and trains and he'd do the screeching and screaming, and people were like, oh, he's so cute, he's so lovely. And then up till age about 8 and 9, I can say that people were just generally so kind and so lovely on trains and places, because you just say, oh, sorry, awesome, or whatever. And they were, they didn't understand fully, they weren't aggressive towards you. But as he got older, unfortunately, we ended up having to stop going on trains and public transport, because he loves it. He loves going on trains and buses and so on. But a couple of times, you know, you'd have an incident where he's got anxious, or he'll start these odd or awkward Tourette-like behaviours, and start burping very loudly. And, you know, people, on one occasion, this chap said to me, don't bring that near me. Don't come, you know, don't bring him anywhere near to sit down next to me. That was one incident. Another incident was, Sian just, he was in a supermarket and he rushed up to a man and he had an open zip on his shirt. And Sian ran up and then shut his zipper. And, of course, this man was just about to really get aggressive with Sian, and because he obviously got scared himself. And I had to rush in and sort of just pull him aside and say, you know, I'm so sorry, he's got autism. And fortunately, the man was okay. You know, most recently what's happened is he's outside with his dad washing the car, and he's sort of gone through the garage and come out the other side door. Now, normally a normal 16-year-old would be able to do that. Not, sorry to use the word normal, but a 16-year-old would be able to do that and wander around up and down the street and so on. But with Sian, you can't allow him to do that. He knocked on, must have knocked on neighbor's door and so on. We didn't know, so we were looking for him all over the house. First time he's done this. Well, he did this when he was about 4 or 5 years old. And so we had to call the police and say, look, we need help because he's disappeared. Explain the situation. But we now know that we will need to sort out some labels or something that he wears on himself so that if he does do that again or goes further down the road or something, then he can be somebody can bring him home. What he had actually done was that he'd gone 3 doors down and knocked on a neighbour's door, and they'd actually sort of thought, well, who's this, and worried because he wasn't speaking. So they invited him in. He went in and he sat down, and the lady, neighbour, she phoned the police as well. So we both had phoned the police, and the police turned up. Now, everybody there was... now, come on, it doesn't matter, you're okay, oh, that's great, you know, you're okay. And I had to say to the police, you actually need to say to him, don't do that again, because he will do it again if he gets this sort of response, that everybody thinks it's, okay, it doesn't matter. But if he does that again, within a few weeks or whatever, the police are going to get fed up with it, I would imagine, and we'll be facing all sorts of problems. So in terms of also just moving around, we've had to reduce it. And if we do go anywhere, we go by car, although he loves buses and so on. He loves to travel and go on an aeroplane. But now we are a little bit concerned about if we go on an aeroplane, if he does have a behaviour, how are we going to deal with it? So you have to prepare a lot beforehand. You always have to prepare a lot beforehand, do the social stories, explanations about things, because you may get certain behaviours that are going to be really disruptive or upsetting to other people. But to Sian, he doesn't always understand that they're having a negative negative attention. It's to him, he's trying to socialise and it's attention, so he's kind of enjoying it. He loves seeing people's reactions when he does something crazy. And for example, I was outside my parents' house trying to get into our car, and he stood there, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to try and cross the road, which a 16-year-old should be able to do, and he probably would be all right to cross the road. But we have to be very careful because once he crosses the road, where's he going to go? He doesn't have any places to go to other than if he's with you. But anyway, outside the house, he threw something at a passing car. The car screeched and stopped, and they're just about to come out to me and say, what's going on, sort of thing. They see a 16-year-old lad, so immediately, you get really worried that they're going to attack both of you or get angry with both of you. And you have to kind of immediately to put them at, say, can you stop? Because I have a person who has a disability with me, has autism, then in some cases people understand, in other cases people don't understand, and they can get a bit aggressive, but that's part and parcel of being a carer for your son with autism. The spectrum is so wide that I just think that there's just not enough understanding of the whole disability, and I just think there isn't anybody there who can throw light on, or we haven't come across anybody who can say to us, well, look, if you can help in this way or help in that way. I mean, partly, you know, I've come to kind of think, well, this is my son. This is who he is. And he has these difficulties. How, you know, we've created the infrastructures all around us. Perhaps if there weren't so many streets and so many houses and so much lighting when he goes to, if he goes to a shopping centre, right, it's the infrastructure is created by us. If that wasn't there, if he lived somewhere where there wasn't all this lighting and all this noise, the aeroplanes and so on, maybe he would be functioning okay. Maybe he would be communicating better. So I don't know, really, to be honest. It just seems to be one of those disabilities that are so complicated. For example, if you have a physical disability, you can work out, right, this person can be helped with either, say something like cerebral palsy. You can, there are certain things that you can do to help certain muscles and so on. With us, there doesn't seem to be anything that can help. Nobody seems to understand it.
This is the final clip from the interview that we had with Parul, and obviously it doesn't end on the most kind of happy note, but I think what she speaks about here is trying to find the balance between age, between disability, between society, between an understanding that a child has a disability or a learning disorder, whatever you want to call it, and the fact that they still need to take responsibility. And so when Stian does things that are naughty, you can't say, oh, it's okay, it's all right, you've got autism, don't worry about it. But equally, you can't be like, you're being terrible, you're doing things wrong, because it's a combination of things, isn't it? Autism can manifest as a behavioural difficulty as well. And I think that's what's so hard here, isn't it?
I think as well, my kind of impression from what Parul was saying was that actually the reactions that Stian receives from things that he's done or his actions actually can either reinforce and encourage habits or discourage them. And I think that's, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what it sounded like to me, that she was saying that if you say, oh, it's fine, and like almost kind of don't say, oh, you know, you can't do that, don't do that again, actually it could encourage a pattern of behaviour.
Yeah, it's really difficult because, like, as a carer, you have a responsibility, don't you? Being a carer isn't just about loving someone, it's about responsibility.
It's about looking after them, and also, you know, it goes beyond just making sure that they're dressed in the morning.
Yeah, and this is the thing, you don't know what the right thing to do is. And, like, Brule, my mum, is incredibly calm when people get angry and stuff. She's brilliant at dealing with it. I tend to get really angry, and I tend to kind of, like, not mouth off per se, but I can't keep my cool in those situations, because you become so protective of the person that you care for. And my mum has a way of kind of going in and diffusing the situation really well. It's something you learn over time, I think. And there's another thing, you have to balance how protective you are over someone with the fact that, like, things impact other people.
I think as well, because there's a lack of help, and there isn't, as Parul has said, there isn't that organisation or body that you can go to who can tell you what to do. It must be so difficult to know what to do, because actually it sounds like no one knows.
I think Stian gets a few hours, or my parents get a few hours of respite a week. It's not very much. So you're pretty much in that carer role 24/7. And your approach changes, you know, if you're having a really bad day and you're really stressed out, and he won't stop burping at you, because that's one of his tics, he kind of burps at people, and it's encouraged some very interesting responses. You know, you're going to get annoyed. Even as a carer, you're going to get annoyed, but it's something I think about other people it's like there was this time recently where we were in a park, like a children's park, and Stian stole this little girl's scooter, and this woman started yelling at him, and it took every ounce of strength in my body not to like just lose it with her. But you can't, because that doesn't raise awareness.
I know. And also, like, because of the invisibility of autism,
exactly,
this girl's mum,
it wasn't the mum. It wasn't her mum. It was just some woman.
Okay. So the woman in the park, she's not seeing the same thing that we might see, which is Stian, and we know that he's got autism. She's seeing a 16-year-old boy who's stealing a little girl's scooter. So it would...
Exactly.
It might encourage a different response. But the problem is that, you know, you don't always know what's going on with someone else. You don't always know what their situation is. And I feel like a lot of the time people, especially in the moment, give a knee-jerk response and they forget that actually they don't, and they forget that they don't know the situation.
What do the words "but you don't look sick" mean to you, and how does this relate to your son's experience?
Well, if you look at him, you wouldn't be able to tell initially that he has autism, because he looks he's gorgeous, handsome lad, and has humour and all that sort of stuff. So I suppose to me, I don't see him as someone who's sick. I just see other people as not being able to understand that he's different, that he's just another... Okay. Majority of us, at some point or other, are going to have a disability as we get older. And at that point, we'll understand that things have changed for us, and that how our body functions or our brain functions, with Alzheimer's or dementia, whatever we might get, we'll see the world differently. And I think that... my son is not sick, right? You haven't got the understanding to just be able to see that he's very different. You know, that's it. I mean, he's not sick. He's not sick. Sorry. You're sick. How dare you call my son sick, slap. That would be my reaction. That's the thing with autism as well. It's just that the person who has autism, I suspect, doesn't think that they're sick, you know, that there's anything wrong with them, unless they are ill with something like a flu or having that. That's a bit of a struggle when you feel there's certain things you want to do that you can't do, or that it takes you longer to do. That must be so hard.
Each week, we ask the people that feature on this podcast to give a word that they feel best sums up their experience.
Perul's going to go next.
Trojan.
Severance.
Frustrating.
Alliance.
Courage.
Tune in to our next episode as we continue our exploration into invisible illness. You can find us on URN's Facebook page, Audio Boom, and Mixcloud.
This is URN.